And good morning once again. Hour number two of the Chad Holmes Show, Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 12:30. The time is 9:06. Sunny skies and 55 degrees is the temperature. Again, I spent much of the weekend down in Madison. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association had their awards event on Saturday night and was very proud to be nominated for an interview, best interview for Media Market Radio, and got second place, which was a great honor from the WBA. And the interview was with author Kenneth Farmer. And I thought we'd bring back this interview. He is the author from Stevens Point of Lee, the tragic story of a family broken by schizophrenia. So I thought we'd share it again because I think it's still just as timely. And here's my conversation with Ken Farmer. Very happy to welcome into studio an author from Stevens Point, Kenneth Farmer, who has a new book out. It's a memoir titled Lee, the Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. And first of all, Kenneth, thank you for actually coming over and making the trek over here to Wausau. It's always much nicer to be able to talk across the table as opposed to being on the phone. But I really appreciate you coming on over here to Wausau.
Thank you, Chad. Thanks for having me.
Well, the first thing, very quickly in your book, I think it was in the introduction, you said you thought more than 1,000 times about doing this, and every time it ended up being no. Why did you ultimately say yes to this story, which is more than the title says Lee, but it really is the entire family story of your family? What made you say, I'm ready to take that leap and write about issues that, you know, very, very painful on one hand and very personal generally, and I think there's a natural inclination for anybody to step back from the very personal. Why did you make the jump to write this book?
Well, I went to the law school at the University of Louisville, and I was a public defender after law school, and my very first boss was a guy named Dan Goyette, who retired in 2017 or 2018, and he and I met after his retirement party in Milwaukee. He was originally from Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. And I was considering writing my third book. I had written two novels before then, and I was going to write another novel on criminal justice. And he said, when he learned about my brother's case, well, why don't you write about your brother? Mm-hmm. He says, that would be a lot more salient. And so he convinced me to do it. I didn't really want to do it even then. The stigma of mental illness bridled me even then. You know, I imagine, you know, if there's a heaven, that my mother would be confronting me saying, why did you tell all these family secrets? And he convinced me that my family wouldn't in the end look bad in the book, that this would be something that would be very valuable for the public to learn from the perspective not only of a lawyer that dealt with those kind of cases and a prosecutor ultimately. Later, I was a prosecutor that dealt with those kind of cases, but somebody who had personally experienced it. He thought that it would definitely be do the public good to hear it.
Let's talk about your family, because this is a book that is about your family. It's Lee is the title. That's your older brother. You got yourself, and you got your parents. Let's start with Lee. Because one of the things that jumps out quickly is he was brilliant. As a 12-year-old and even younger than that, reading, he had a really brilliant mind. He had a poem on Abraham Lincoln that was published very young in his life. He was brilliant, but it's also sounded like very early, you as a very young boy, whether I think 6 or 7 years old, saw there was something there.
Yeah, there's no question that my brother was different. He was, while he was mentoring me very much when I was younger, did a lot of great things for me, he definitely was withdrawn. He had very few friends. He was depressive at times. He had a lot of the standard precursors of schizophrenia. You know, There are kids who are schizophrenic, but it's very rare. It's like 2% of the schizophrenics have it when they're a child. But a lot of them have these precursors, which is different than that. And he definitely had those. But I was a little kid. I didn't know about precursors or anything, you know. And he was definitely different, and there were things about him that I remember when he was 12 years old. He suddenly said that he was going to run away from home. You know, kids at 12 years old say that kind of stuff all the time. And I said, well, why do you want to run away from home? He says, to go to Florida to hunt tropical fish. I said, hunting tropical fish? He said, well, I want to make $1 million at it. And that was the part that bothered me the most, even at that age.
Let's talk about your parents, because very early in the, in the first chapter, you start off with a heartwarming story about you and your brother going out and, you know, in the rain. And then it goes into the darker side in your mother and your father. Could you maybe just give a sketch, a foundation of who your mother and father were?
Well, my mother had her own problems. She was physically disabled. She was paralyzed on the entire right of her body and raised us with one arm and one leg. And she had, as a result of that, I think her own paranoia or paranoid type issues. She was always in arguments with the neighbors as to whether they were setting foot on her property. And it was like on a weekly basis, she'd be screaming about that kind of thing with them. And she was always accusing her siblings of stealing things from her family. And so she definitely set an example of paranoia. And my father was, you know, his mother died at 8. He was raised by his uncle. He was very explosive. He had a very bad temper. He disciplined us with a belt and with his fist. He did the things that you're not supposed to do as a parent that are a breeding ground for violence later. So there was a genetic component to my brother's mental illness, but there also was an environmental aspect to it that made it so that it was even worse.
Again, we're talking to Kenneth Farmer, the author of the new memoir, Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. As I was reading it, do you think there was a connection between the violence within your household and maybe the paranoia that you saw within your mother and your brother's issues, or was that just separate? Because I was trying to kind of put it together myself, and I really was not able to put that together. Was it just, for lack of a better term, coincidence?
No, it wasn't a coincidence. I think that it was significant for my brother. Not all schizophrenics are violent. Many of them aren't. There's probably a higher percentage of violence among them than a normal, quote, normal person. Mm-hmm. But I could see when we had violent episodes, the way my brother acted was like mom acted with the neighbors. The way my brother dealt with things with friends was with his fist sometimes. He got that from my dad. I remember seeing him in a fight where he was just beating the hell out of some kid. And he had in his eyes the eyes that my father had when he used the belt on us.
One word that kind of jumped out during the early years in the run-up to when your brother became a young adult and you were forced to take the next steps is denial.
Yeah.
Could you talk about how the word denial and the thought of denial for a long time kind of froze your family? Would that be a way to put it?
Well, everyone kind of knew there was something wrong with my brother, but they didn't do anything about it. And I think a lot of that had to do, well, some of it was ignorance, but a lot of it was just the denial that on my parents' behalf that their son had this very severe psychiatric disease. And it was so bad, my brother got to a point where he was obviously having hallucinations. He was obviously talking to people that weren't there, laughing with them all night long, keeping us up. And what was really weird about it was that he would do this at the dinner table. And my parents wouldn't do anything about it. They knew that there was something wrong. And here you're at the dinner table, and he'd be doing this, and my father would say, "Well, Lee, would you like some bread?" And he'd snap out of it for a second and go right back into it. Same thing with pass the milk. You know, and so I think some of it was my mother, though. My mother didn't want us to say a thing about this. She was opposed to the commitment proceedings.
I was going to say that was your brother was physically abusive to your mother, significantly, and yet she did not want, she would not sign the papers.
No.
And that was, you were in college, I believe, when you first time about an involuntary commitment.
Right.
And it just got to the point where you couldn't deny it anymore, but yet your mother, despite the fact that your brother had been physical against her, just would not sign those papers, and she never would.
Never would. And in Wisconsin, you have to have three signatures for a commitment petition. A lot of states just have one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's if you were to change anything, that's one thing I would change in Wisconsin. But it came time to commit my brother. It got to the point where I was the one that took the lead on it at 19 years old. Not my parents. And
going to school at UWSP at the
time,
correct?
Yes, I was. And I went to my college debate coach, this guy named C.Y. Allen, and he contacted the district attorney's office, and they told us, well, there's this proceeding called a commitment proceeding. You need three signatures saying he's dangerous to himself or others and mentally ill. And so I organized a family meeting about it. My mother absolutely refused to sign it. So we had just two signatures, myself and my dad. My mother said, "You will ruin him, and I will never forgive you if you do it." So it was very difficult for me. And we finally found a third signature.
And I believe you wrote when somebody called you up as a witness to your brother's schizophrenia, you said to yourself, "Thank God."
Yeah.
That you had somebody else that saw it.
Well, that was in the second petition. And the first petition was a colleague of my father's that did sign.
You're right. Yeah,
Second petition, though, that's correct. We still had to have three signatures. And it was like a gift from God that this guy, he was a person that lived at a rooming house where my brother was.
And we will have more with Kenneth Farmer, author from Stevens Point, in just a few moments here on Bow Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230. And we are continuing my previous conversation with author Kenneth Farmer, author from Stevens Point, of Lee, the tragic story of a family broken by schizophrenia.
A lighter story that I just, you know, within this very heavy story, you had this story when you were living in Stevens Point, I think you were still in school, where you had some friends who wanted you to hitchhike to Appleton, and you ended up in a car full of strippers. I have to admit, I found that to be such a funny story. Could you kind of touch on that? Number one, the idea of these days of hitchhiking from Stevens Point to Appleton in the middle of winter was crazy in itself.
Right.
But then who picked you up?
Well, yeah, that happened. What was interesting, the reason it was relevant to the story of Lee was I spent a lot of time alone and away from my family. By then, I had moved out of my house and was living in Stevens Point. Yeah, I was a sophomore in college then. And, you know, of course, you partied a lot then. And certainly partying for me, especially of marijuana, was something that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a call from a friend, and he said, "What are you doing there all alone?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm just hanging out here." And he goes, "Well, we're partying down in Appleton." And so I said, "Well, I can't get there. I'm sorry, my car isn't working." So we'll hitchhike. And this was like, it was dark, it was snowing. And I got on the road and Highway 10, you know, and 10 was a two-lane road then.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody was picking me up. Semis are going by. I mean, people hitchhiked a lot then. You just did. It doesn't happen now. And a carload of strippers picked me up and brought me to Oshkosh. And I said, "Well, I got to get from Oshkosh to Appleton, where the party was." And they said they'd take me up there if I helped them unload their stuff. And but they never did.
You helped them unload it.
I had to call the phone, you know. But what was funny about it was just how these strippers were, you know. And I don't know how much you want to get on the radio about it, but you know they definitely were humorous about what they did and would throw things at me and talk about their acts and things like that. But it was like, wow, you know.
I would suggest get the book just for the stripper stories. And also your buddy said, hey, I know exactly where you are.
Right, exactly. They came down and got me.
That was so funny. Going back again to, I think, the denial aspect, one line that kind of, and I was writing notes as I was reading it, it was one of the emergency detentions of your brother, and you were at, I think you may have already left Wisconsin. You were back, and I think you may have been in law school, and it was, you were at the table, and a discussion with your parents about another emergency detention and also the fact that your brother had been physical with your mother. And in the middle of it, instead of talking about it, your mother says, would anyone like ice cream?
Yeah.
Again, your father's trying to bring up this incredibly serious subject, and in the middle, before he is able to get out, would anybody like ice cream? Again, right. I thought it was another example of how difficult any moment in these discussions is.
Yeah, it definitely was. My mother, in particular, was very much wanted to cover that situation up. It was, and that's probably why she said what she said. She wanted to change the subject, move on to something else. And what had happened was, I was in my first year of law school, which was very stressful. And my parents, of course, viewed me as family hero, you know, the person that was going to succeed and make up for my brother, I think. And so they didn't want to do anything to disrupt or my concentration or my focus. And so they never told me about this when I was in law school, and it happened my first semester of school there. And I came home for Christmas, and we had a conversation at the dinner table. My brother was in a different room, and they said, my dad said, well, we had a problem with Lee, because I noticed that my mother had bangs. She never wore her hair in bangs. You know, and I said, well, why you have bangs? And my mother said, just don't worry about it. Just forget it. And my dad said, you might as well tell him. And my mother didn't want to do that. And so I, you know, eventually I went downstairs to talk to my brother where he was. And he said, I hit Mom. And that's all he said. He made it sound like it was one time. And I later found out he had put her in the hospital.
Much later, actually.
Much later.
I mean, it really was a case where it was much more serious than you could have probably even imagined at that
time. Right. My mother was crippled. And for him to beat her up. And then what was really weird about it was that I worked as a prosecutor in Madison. And a female prosecutor down there came up to me and she goes, I want you to know I know your brother. I prosecuted him on that emergency detention. And she mentioned that she saw the pictures of my mother, and she said that they were the worst pictures she had ever seen in her career. My mother's face was beaten to a pulp. So he didn't just hit her. Yeah.
Let's talk about the issue of family hero. We were talking about this during the break, that I think can be beyond even your situation. We were talking about, you know, families of alcoholics and other families that have difficult issues where you have one member of the family that is going through their problems and issues, and then another member of the family that's almost like, I have to hold up the ceiling, otherwise it's going to fall
right
on top of all of us. And and during the course of your entire life, it feels like that was something that was with you. It affected a lot of the decisions, I think, that you've made during your life. Could you talk a little bit about that dynamic within your family and how it either comes across within your life and within the book?
Well, I was always expected to do way more to make up for my brother. And this is a common phenomenon in schizophrenic families, families of alcoholics, any kind of dysfunctional situation. But I had to make up for him, and there was no room for error for me. I was an Eagle Scout,
Right.
I went to law school. The
thing about real quickly, your brother. Again, it seems like almost every decision that you made in terms of getting involved in something, the seed was planted by your brother, wasn't it?
Yes. You know, and there was a certain irony in that, because my brother really wasn't that successful at things, but he sort of projected his desire for success onto me. He said, when I was 10 years old, he said, it's time you decide what you're going to do when you grow up. And then we decided that because it was him and me, decided I was going to be a lawyer. You know, he's the one that, at 11 years old, insisted I be an Eagle Scout. And not just be an Eagle Scout. Be an Eagle Scout at 12, which is literally an impossible thing to do.
Right.
When I was 13, I remember him, there was a kid at school who said, you know, that there was an announcement over the loudspeaker about being involved in forensics. Mm-hmm. And I went to the meeting about it, and the kid said, essentially, you don't belong here. I don't want to see you get hurt. Maybe you should consider another activity.
Mr. Know-it-all, right?
Mr. Know-it-all. You know, and so I went home with my brother, and my brother was the one who said, don't pay attention to what that jerk says. Mm-hmm. You're going to learn how to write a speech. And my brother made me write my first speech on the Middle East conflict. And he said, don't ever let somebody try to tell you you can't do something.
And we will conclude our discussion with author Kenneth Farmer of Stevens Point and his book, Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia, after we have an information update. News, weather, and sports coming up, and then more with Ken Farmer here on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230.
Cause lovers, that is the fact. Yes, we're lovers.
98.9 and 1230. Again, we are going back to a conversation I had with Stevens Point author Kenneth Farmer, Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. And again, it's an interview that I was honored over the weekend by the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, so thought we'd bring it back for you. Here's the final few minutes of our conversation.
There was there was a powerful scene in your book where you're around the dinner table and you finally almost like had enough, where I forget the details that led up to it, but basically you said that in a sense that it's always been all about Lee and that you just do what you do and it's almost like being expected. And it felt like you weren't being loved in a sense. Could you talk about those feelings? What point was that?
Yeah, that was, I was, having problems in school, frankly. I was using too much weed. I was missing class.
Your father knew about it because he was a teacher.
And he brought it up.
Yeah.
He was a teacher at UWSP, an economics professor, and he brought it up and that I was missing class. I'm not, going to help you pay for school if you're going to not go to class, blah, blah, blah. And so in the conversation, I became upset about the fact that it seemed like they were doing everything for my brother and very little about me. I had made a tremendous sacrifice. I stayed home for school when I could have gone away to school, just because of my brother. And again, that's that anger, that resentment by siblings of the schizophrenic is an extremely common phenomenon in families.
There was also a nice moment after that, though, where you found, I think your mother had about the Eagle Scouts.
Right.
That little bit of, hey, my mom does love me.
Right.
That was, I
she
thought.
Did. She loved me for sure. My mother, I went upstairs during this conversation sort of in a huff, and then I saw some of the trophies I got from public speaking contests, and I saw in my room, my sash with all my merit badges when I became an Eagle Scout, and saw the picture of my parents at that ceremony. Mm-hmm. And I remember my mother sewing the patches on my uniform and sewing those merit badges, all 22 of them, on my merit badge sash. Mm-hmm. And any rate, this is a hard thing for me to relate, but I knew that she really cared a lot about me. But at any rate, she had to do this with one hand. She could sew with one hand. She would use her mouth to help thread the needle and hold the needle. And this task, you know, all my ranks and all my merit badges, it would take her an hour to do a merit badge. But she did. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with any clippings in the newspaper I had. She loved me as much as she did my brother.
Another word that kind of, I think, permeates the whole story that affected, I think, in a lot of ways your whole life is the word shame.
Mm-hmm.
That it affected potential relationships, because you didn't want to introduce a girlfriend to
right.
your brother or even your parents.
Right.
And that continued for a long time in your life, didn't it?
Well, it still does. Yeah, that's something that families of the mentally ill definitely have to go through. And it's less now. I think there's more of an attempt to attack that stigma.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a problem for me. I actually went to therapy over it, and it hurt me in relationships, because I never would want them. You know, normally in a relationship, it gets to the point where your significant other or you're the person you're involved in a relationship, it gets to meet your family. And I never wanted to do that. And it created the effect of that I was camping out, so to speak. I wasn't serious about being committed
mm-hmm.
to that person. And so I never got married till I was in my 40s and after my parents were dead. And it was... But in terms of the issue of shame, my brother, I never had him come to any of my ceremonies. Not when I got married, not when I got my Eagle Scout, even though he helped me do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not when I graduated from law school or college or high school, because I was just too embarrassed about the whole thing. I didn't think anyone would understand, and probably they wouldn't have. But a lot of it also was he wasn't around all the time to mm-hmm. even communicate with.
We have to make another quick break, and then we'll come back with a few more minutes with Stevens Point author Kenneth Farmer. Again, brand new memoir, Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. We'll have more coming up. The time is coming up on 9:48. I'm Chad Holmes, Chad Holmes Show on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230, online at bullfallsradio.com. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. So more with Kenneth Farmer coming up next on WXCO. And back here on the Chad Holmes Show on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230, bullfallsradio.com. Mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO and on the Civic Media app. Again, we are joined in studio by Stevens Point author Kenneth Farmer. Brand new memoir titled Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. Obviously, you and your family went through so many difficult issues with your brother. You put him almost, I think, into different boxes. You had the first decade plus where trying to almost ignore it. And then, as you said, when you were 19, you said, we have to do something. We have to get him help. But it was so difficult, the law. I want to ask you about what you and your family had to deal with maybe in 1975, and then you working in the law all these years, and now here in 2023. What is different? What is the same? What lessons do we take from your story when it comes to the issue of schizophrenia?
Well, you know, at the time, there were very few criteria that would enable you to commit someone. They had to be dangerous to themselves or others, and they still do, but there are different ways now in the law that you can be dangerous. You know, not having an ability to understand the pros and cons of treatment, for example, might be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you had to show a recent overt act or threat, and you still do under certain, you know, dangerousness criteria. And you have to have three signatures, and you still do. of people saying that person is mentally ill and dangerous. But what was really significant at the time was that, and I thought it was horrible, that there was not a prosecutor on the case, unless the judge appointed that prosecutor. And in this case, for a long time, in the first commitment at least, there wasn't a prosecutor on the case that, to my knowledge. There was no one that appeared at the preliminary hearing. And that had consequences, because my father worked out an agreement with the public defender, my brother had a public defender at least, where in lieu of the commitment proceeding, he would spend 10 days in a mental hospital in Madison. Mm-hmm. And what happened was, that wasn't enough time. The psychiatrist brought us down there and said, your son is severely mentally ill. My brother was acting out in the hospital. And he said he was extremely dangerous, that he had paranoid schizophrenia, and that 10 days wasn't enough time. Whoever cooked up this agreement was out of their mind. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't be supervised when he got out. So because of that, you know, either the prosecutor was appointed on the case, in which case they shouldn't have agreed to this, or alternatively, the judge never bothered to. But it was in the judge's discretion. That's changed. Mm-hmm. Now corporation counsel does it. And for a long time, the district attorney's office has done it. But back then, it wasn't a guarantee. And so my brother then got out. Naturally, he decompensated. He wasn't being supervised or anything like that. And my father told me he had gone off his meds. And so I went to visit him, and he at a rooming house in Stevens Point, where he was rooming with a bunch of UWSP students. And we found, all right, he wasn't there, my brother, but the door was half cracked open. And I noticed my brother had purchased a shotgun. And my brother had extreme paranoia about an organization called the Black Mafia. It was an illusory organization. It didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And I thought, he's got a shotgun because he's going to defend himself against these people, these imaginary enemies. My brother never hunted in his life. And so I went in there and I saw the shells on the floor. He had purchased the gun, and nobody at the sports shop in Stevens Point, no one even questioned, apparently, the propriety of this. Right. But he wasn't involuntarily committed, remember?
Right.
It was just a voluntary, so they couldn't have stopped him anyway. And so I took the shells, and I didn't want to take the shotgun because that would look stupid walking down the middle of campus with a shotgun, you know.
Even back then.
And so I took but I noticed that the box of shells was full, so I was convinced the gun was not loaded. But I knew something had to be done right away. And I looked on the floor next to the shell, and I saw the receipt for the gun from the sports shop. And I also saw some writings that my brother had written, and one of the writings said, I live in the death house, conveniently located across the street from the funeral parlor. And I looked out the window, and I saw the Boston Funeral Home on Division Street, and I knew my brother meant business. And I broke out into a cold sweat. I really did. And so, as far as then versus now, that shouldn't have happened and wouldn't happen. I think that there would be a prosecutor in a case that would make sure, that would not have agreed to that agreement under those circumstances. The public would have been protected better than it was then, for sure.
We're in our last 2 minutes, and there's so much more that I think we could talk about.
Right.
One thing I want to point out to folks is to get the book, because we didn't talk about a couple of, I think, stories at the end that were, I would call them, those surprising stories. You call it, if you were writing a fiction novel, probably call them twists, you know, a little twist right at the end. So I would encourage people, because there's so much more within the stories we've talked about here. But bottom line, one thing that comes across in this book, and I said it to you when we first met, is when you read about your family, there's still one thing that comes across is, even with, I said your father at the beginning of the book was, you considered not a hero at all, that he'd be the bad guy, but in the end, the love came through for his wife, for his family. And I also said, one thing I imagine that you want to underline is the incredible love for your brother that you have. That he was truly the first best bud that you ever had, and through incredible highs and lows and many lows, that never changed, did it?
No, it never did. My brother was a very significant figure in my life. He was very much a mentor. Without my brother, I'd never be a lawyer. I'd never been an Eagle Scout. I never would have been, well, I don't know. Maybe I would have been something, but I wouldn't have been as successful as I was. And then same thing with my father. There were many good things my father did, too. And the same with my mother. My mother was always an example of resilience and improvising and overcoming, given her disability. But what's interesting about that whole thing was I learned things about my family that I didn't know as the process went on, and they come out in the book.
Yeah.
And they demonstrate a very important thing, and that is that there is good in people, and there's a reason why they have some bad. And that you should also be very careful what you say to people or do to people, because not only does it affect them, it can affect others that they in turn have contact with. And that was something that, you know, that I as an author learned through that process, and I would hope that other people would too.
Ken Farmer, author from Stevens Point, Lee, The Tragic Story of a Family Broken by Schizophrenia. Again, cannot recommend it highly enough. You can get it at Amazon.com or check out his website, KenFarmerWrites.com. That's KenFarmerWrites.com. We'll have our daily history lesson coming up next here on Bow Falls Radio. Nine 51 here on Monday morning, the 6th day of May, 2024. Again, just heard, again, an interview that I'd previously had with Ken Farmer, the author of Lee. Really interesting book. And, again, over the weekend, I was down in Madison at the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association, and that interview was nominated for an award, which was very nice. It was a lot of fun, and, again, TV folks and radio folks, and I had a chance to talk to some very interesting people from civic media, really an opportunity where I don't see them a whole lot because we're here in Wausau. We got stations around the state, but it was just a fantastic Saturday to be able to really connect with a lot of folks from the broadcasting world. And again, congratulations to the civic media folks who won awards. Also, thanks congrats here in Wausau to, as I said earlier, to Channel 7, WSAW TV 7. They were the small market TV station of the year at the Wisconsin Broadcasters Association Awards this weekend as well. So again, I kind of call it the broadcaster's prom. We all get dressed up nice and we have a good time. We get fed, which is always nice, you know. But it was a fun night, and it's always fun to see people within your business and you get a chance to connect as well. So, and again, I thought that would be a good chance to bring back, because that I want to again give another opportunity for you to learn about that story and a chance to learn about the issue of schizophrenia, and also again give you an opportunity to get the book, because as I said previously, back when we first did the interview, Ken Farmer sent me a copy of the book. And I have to admit that, I had to read the whole book here to get ready for an interview. It was almost like homework. But once I started reading the book, it was such a page-turner. It was such an interesting story. It was so much more than just a story of schizophrenia. It was a story of a family. It was a story of a man you know, dealing with such a big issues within his family. It was a story about Central Wisconsin. It had just everything that made for a very interesting page turner. So again, I would encourage you, if you have not had a chance to get the book, check it out. Go to your bookseller, go to Amazon.com, and again, go to Ken's website, KenFarmerWrites.com. And it's Writes, W-R-I-T-E-S, KenFarmerWrites.com. And he's also had other books that I would encourage you to check out as well. And it was really, I'm glad for Ken that also we got a little bit of acknowledgement for that interview, because he deserves, I think, for people to read this book. And again, I would just really encourage you to check it out. Check out, you know, if you have a chance to buy the book or read the book, you won't be disappointed. I can guarantee you that. This is day number 127 of 2024. It is 239 days remaining in this year. Some famous events have occurred on this date in history. 1889, the Eiffel Tower was opened to the public at the Universal Exposition in Paris. On this date in 1946, the New York Yankees became the first Major League Baseball team to travel by plane. On this date in 1954, Roger Bannister became the first person to run the mile in under 4 minutes. On this date in 1965, Keith Richards fell asleep while improvising with a new guitar. The next morning, he could not remember the riffs, but "I Can't Get No Satisfaction" had been preserved on a tape recorder. On this date in 2017, France banned two thin fashion models. Too thin, not T-W-O, but T-O-O thin. Too thin fashion models, and made labeling of digitally enhanced photos mandatory. And on this date in 2020, again, in the midst of COVID, it was announced that COVID-19 had infected at least 90,000 healthcare workers worldwide. Some famous people are celebrating their birthdays today. Baseball legend Willie Mays, 660 home runs in his incredible career, ranking fourth all-time. Willie Mays, 93 years old today. Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band is 79. Former Dancing with the Stars host Tom Bergeron is 69. Actor Roma Downey from Touched by an Angel is 64. George Clooney, actor, came to fame on ER, but then became a big movie star, Ocean's 11 and others. George Clooney is 63 years old today. Actor Naomi Scott of the live-action Aladdin is 31 years old today. And if you're out there celebrating your birthday, happy birthday to you from all of us at Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230. This week, it is National Nurses Week, Be Kind to Animals Week, Anxiety and Depression Awareness Week. It is Correctional Officers Week. It is Tick Awareness Week. It is also Pet Week, Update Your References Week, Craft Brewers Week. It is Food Allergy Awareness Week. It is this one right down your alley. It is National Stuttering Awareness Week.
Very important.
Yep, and you've really done a fantastic job on stage and here on this program, and able to show again that nothing stops you. Nope. When you put your mind to it, right?
Exactly.
It is Teacher Appreciation Week as well. It is No Diet Day, Beverage Day, International No Diet Day, National Nurses Day, Tourist Appreciation Day, and No Homework Day. I doubt the teachers are following that, though. All right. Time to start a new week.
Yes, it is.
You had a good week last week. Mm-hmm. You got over 33%. Again, yes. We give you three choices every day, and then you have to get two out of five is a successful week. Yes, but we want to get you even better than that. All right. Our number for the day. The number of meteorites collected in Antarctica over the years, all the years.
Antarctica. Okay.
By scientists. So okay. Meteorites collected in Antarctica over the years by scientists. Is the correct answer 10,000 meteorites? Is the correct answer 40,000 meteorites? Is the correct answer 80,000 meteorites? So 10,000, 40,000, or 80,000? What number of meteorites were collected in Antarctica over the years by scientists?
I'm going to go with I'm B. I'm going to go with 40,000. I'm just taking a guess on this. That's my final answer.
The answer is 80,000. Oh, it was the highest number. The biggest number today. So.
Drat.
All right. You got plenty of time. It's all for one. You got four more days to get it right.
Yeah,
so you have to get 2 out of 4 now. You have to get 50% the rest of the week.
2 out of 4. Yes.
All right, Ian. We'll have a great Monday. We'll catch you tomorrow.
You too, Chad. Happy Monday, everybody.
And everybody stick around. Information update followed by Matt and Air on Air. And then we'll be back tomorrow, 8 till 10, here on Bull Falls Radio, 98.9 and 1230.